Welcome back to the Groundless Ground Podcast, the leading edge of integrative mental health. I'm your host, Lisa Dale Miller. You can subscribe to, download, and review the Groundless Ground on iTunes, Google Play, YouTube, Stitcher, TuneIn, and of course, find out more at groundlessground.com. I'm ready to go. How about you? Paula Scatoloni is a somatic psychotherapist and certified eating disorders specialist in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. Our dialogue explicates the insufficiency of standardized cognitive and behavioral eating disorder treatment and introduces embodied recovery, a cutting-edge somatopsychosocial approach which considers the body and embodiment the missing link for effective treatment of disordered eating. Paula provides an overview of her co-created embodied recovery training program, along with its guiding principles for attending to and helping patients heal the trauma and attachment-related injuries, which often lie at the root of eating disordered behaviors. Join us as Paula and I investigate this exciting integrative paradigm shift currently emerging in the field of eating disorder treatment.
Paula, it is wonderful to have you on the Groundless Ground. We're about to go into a territory that I certainly am interested in, which is why I'm so happy to have you here, someone who has been working in the eating disorders community for what appears to be many, many years.
2 decades. It's a long time.
I imagine you've seen quite the evolution in treatment for eating disorders in all that time.
I have. It has come a long way. It still has a ways to go because we do not have an idea long-term recovery, but we are, I think, getting closer to being able to offer something that provides long-term recovery and freedom.
In your bio on your website, you describe a journey many of us have had with psychotherapy and being a psychotherapist. You started with traditional talk therapy and expressive arts modalities. And then something else showed up. You're not somebody who's just been doing eating disorders in private practice. You have had real skin in the game. I'd love for you to share with our listeners some of your history and some of the sites you've worked at, modalities you've actually had a hand in creating for eating disorders treatment.
I would love to do that. My journey started as a personal journey, as many of us in my own recovery, till becoming an eating disorder professional. So I know this work from that angle and as a practitioner in terms of what long-term recovery means. As a practitioner, I came into the field in the late 80s, early 90s. It was a time where feminist perspective was starting to emerge.
It was the beginning of understanding eating disorders through cognitive behavioral strategies, through object relations, a little dabbling of art therapy, maybe trauma on the fringes. Maybe had trauma.
Trauma, what is that?
It was way over there in the corner, right? My mentors were the pioneers at that time. Dr. Anita Johnston, who understood eating disorder through the lens of metaphor. Carolyn Costin, who understood it through relational lens. Catherine Zerbe, who understood the cultural lens and gender. These were the pioneers. They were all women. They shepherded me into the field. We had conferences and it was very rich and robust and great conversations. And a lot of what we saw was anecdotal. We didn't have a lot of research, but we knew eating disorders were about relationship to self, emotional regulation, capacity for assertion, boundaries, but these things were all floating around. We would come together and discuss, and I think we were learning as we were moving along in those early years, late 90s. Then there was the introduction of DBT. DBT is going to solve everything, so let's throw that into eating disorder treatment. And the interesting piece about that and mindfulness in general is people with eating disorders are body phobic. So you're going to ask them to go in their body and just wait and watch, and it just does not work. How do you bring people into their bodies in a safe way when they do not want to be in their bodies? And they're doing everything they can to be disembodied. I dabbled in Gestalt. I dabbled in creative arts and mindful movement. I had this feeling, I had this experience on the Big Island when I was at a training called Tending the Feminine Psyche with Carolyn Costin. And I just felt this calling to leave Hawaii and begin to go and study embodiment. I spent some time in Portland, Oregon, and hung out with dance movement therapists for a while, and then ended up securing a job at Duke University, where I facilitated a multidisciplinary team of eating disorder professionals and offered a movement-based class for Duke students to deepen their experience in their bodies. And then I also taught the mindful movement class at a treatment center. And the movement did provide a entry point into the body that seemed easier than talk therapy. And it was while I was at Duke that I stumbled upon somatic experiencing. The people who knew me said, Paula, you need to go do this. It's coming to North Carolina. From the moment I walked into the somatic experiencing training, I knew, I could see that the nervous system was the hub.
It's the hub.
And then I could see the attachment system and the nervous system piece.
Absolutely, because all that attachment trauma just overactivates and creates the defensive structures in the nervous system to survive.
Exactly. And that's the paradox with eating disorder treatment. The body has not been included in treatment. So eating disorder treatment has been primarily cognitive.
And behavioral. How weird that is for someone with an eating disorder. All they're doing is getting a kick out of controlling their behavior.
Mm-hmm.
So a behavioral approach is kind of feeding the addict.
And is a red herring because it takes you away from what the real issue is. So somatic experiencing was the beginning. It provided me with an understanding of regulation and a language to talk about that. It provides me with opportunities that I can offer to my clients about how to safely come into contact with the body. And one of the most important pieces, I call it building the body container. Clients with eating disorders don't actually have a body container. And so you're really winding it back to the beginning. How do you build a somatic sense of self that's not there? It's beyond a trauma processing model. It's offered many, many avenues for intervention for me. I entered this somatic experiencing training, and about 4 years into the training, I had already started teaching aspects of SE to professionals. I met a sensory motor psychotherapist at the treatment center, Rachel Lewis Marlowe, who's my business partner now. And she was also seeing results that were very different than what we had seen when we were applying other modalities. And so we began to have discussions, evolved the embodied recovery model.
Which is a training that the two of you have put together, and you're offering that now.
We are. I had studied Diane Poole Heller and some of the professionals of the SE community that offer attachment-based training. Rachel had studied Pat Ogden's model of working with attachment. And so we brought that together and began to flesh out the attachment piece and the difference between attachment trauma and attachment deficits. The beautiful piece about sensory motor and the Hokomi is the understanding of character strategies. What we found is those character strategies are illustrated in the eating disorder behaviors. So you can figure out the character strategy by the eating disorder behavior. You are sort of working both the defense system and the attachment system at the same time. The other model I haven't talked about that we utilize, so I'll backtrack a little. I understood the attachment piece mostly. My mentoring was through Carolyn Costin and object relations. And when Alan Shore and Dan Siegel started talking more publicly about attachment and its connection to regulation, they opened a big right box. And then Stephen Porges came in with polyvagal theory. Now we have three different researchers, can't forget Bruce Perry, who can show us about how attachment works with regulation and when that's not there. And it can be extreme in terms of trauma and neglect and all the way to deficits and things that are missing that continue to influence our ability to reach out to relationship. Part of what we teach in our training is understanding the window of tolerance and attachment, how attachment is built and shaped from 0 to 3. what I believe happens with eating disorders is their window of tolerance is very small.
Their tolerance for what?
What we want to do with embodied recovery is change the lens from which we view eating disorders. The eating disorders are about a lack of capacity to regulate, and that can be due to something neurological in terms of sensory processing, can be due to trauma, or can be due to attachment. When we think about regulation, Dan Siegel has coined the term the window of tolerance. We have a window that enables us to process experiences and emotions and regulate our physiology and stay present during the processing of experiences and have access to our thoughts, our emotions, five sense perception, our whole organization. When we're in this window, we can tolerate experiences successfully. When we have robust early life experiences with our caregiver, there's reciprocal co-regulation, reciprocal interactions happening with the caregiver. It helps to support the development of a robust window. When we don't have a robust window due to sensory processing, trauma, or attachment deficits, what that means is we have a tendency to go outside that window into states of hyperarousal, states of anxiety, panic, agitation, maybe looks like ADHD, maybe looks like OCD. States of hypoarousal are characterized by depression, lethargy, more dissociation from the body. So these two states occur outside of the window. Clients with eating disorders have a small window, either because of something that has happened, pre or perinatal, maybe birth trauma. And then they also have experiences that occur that are traumatic that further pushes them out of the window. They really are stuck not spending much time in this window where they're experiencing regulation.
So what I'm hearing you say, eating disorders is just another manifestation of a coping strategy that an individual would develop in order to survive. Like any number of other coping strategies, they spend much of their time out of optimal arousal, when they just don't have capacity in the nervous system to receive and process and respond to experience.
Yes.
The things that you've just described as sources of maladaptation, eating disorder, it's just one of the choices that an individual system might choose as a maladaptive strategy to survive.
Exactly. It's a management strategy, but it's also an expression of the dysregulation.
So is addiction, using a substance,
yes.
Any number of maladies that we work with.
But excessive running can be an expression of flight response. Purging can be expression of truncated fight response. So the behaviors themselves can tell you what hasn't been processed.
Mm-hmm.
So the behaviors can tell you which character strategy occurs when there's an attachment deficit. The behavior themselves can tell us where that deficit is.
Obviously, this makes so much sense to me. And the direction that you are going in has obviously been a big missing piece. Much of the affective neuroscience that you've beautifully explained, we could just as easily apply this to CBT intervention or apply it to a DBT intervention or apply it to a mindful eating. One of the things that I am thinking as you're speaking is sometimes having mastery over one's own body creates a feeling of safety and a container of safety, which may not have existed early on. This points to the attachment trauma. My mind is putting these two things together, and I am thinking to myself, I wonder if you have the experience at any point when you're working with people and offering them either sensory motor skills, having those relational interactions and the somatic experience, whether you ever have the experience that the feeling of what safety in the body comes away from the delusional idea of safety that eating disordered people have about what it means to have a body that's safe, into something more reflective of the optimal arousal window rather than these extremes.
It can happen fairly quickly, particularly when we utilize a lot of tools that an OT might use with children. that directly intervene with proprioception, vestibular system, and the five senses, right? The tactile system, because there is a sensory integration piece. And so when we intervene at that level and the clients start to feel a sense of organization start to happen, it surprises them and it's fairly quick. And they say, well, why didn't someone share this with me before? I've been to four treatment centers and you're just putting a hot water bottle on my kidney and I'm getting regulated. I don't understand this, Paula. And of course, I'm doing that in the context of relationship. It's working on different levels.
Bottom up is surprising when all people have received this top down.
And it instills hope. I think about my two toughest cases right now who've been in four or five treatment centers. Unfortunately, they became institutionalized and identified as I am an eating disorder. To come and meet with me, who I don't ask about the food, I ask about the regulation. How are you doing today does not mean I want feedback of your food plan for the day. How are you doing means, how are you in the window of tolerance today? Were you out? Were you in? What did you do? They're just quite surprised. And one client recently told me, you know, by my third visit, I started to wonder, when is she going to ask me about the food? And this is very different. And I'm so curious. And I'm going to keep coming back. She is someone who is purging 20 times a day, and we're now going on 2 months of no symptoms.
Have you asked her how it is for her to not be relating to her body in that way, as a vehicle for something rather than as a home? Because she must feel more at home now.
She does. We just had a session where there was a lot of grief about what she's missed because she realizes she was so dissociated from her relationships and from life. And now she's coming back and connecting with people and realizing she wasn't there. It was so isolating and so painful. She still has a ways to go, but there is a home to come to.
Well, this may be a strange question. I wonder whether or not when you think back to the treatment that you used to offer before you were doing the modalities and strategies you're using now, whether there's some grief for you. You think back to people and you wonder what it would have been like if I'd known these things, practiced these. I mean, honestly, we all have this, but I'm just curious.
Yes. I do have sadness, particularly for my clients who had trauma, because I was doing the best I could with the relationship. And I actually did have one client from those past years contact me, and she is studying to be a psychotherapist now. And she sent an email and said, thank you for offering your attachment system. I know what you were doing now. I was providing something, but it certainly wasn't to the degree that she needed, you know, with the trauma resolution. The interesting thing now that I sit with is, what do I do with all the 20 years of training and experience? I don't utilize any of that. When people come to me for training and they come with their books and I've studied CBT and I've studied and I'm ready, and I say, put all that down because you're not going to need that right now. This would be a supervisee. I don't do the food logs. I don't have them draw a picture of their body to talk about their body. I take them into their body to experience their body image. And it just looks very different. I think the most challenging piece of teaching supervisees and anyone on the treatment team about this model is instilling trust that if we work on regulation, the eating disorder thoughts will slow down and will go away, because they're so trained to go after the thought, as if that is what's going to, you know, make the thoughts go away. To instill trust that that peace will calm down and disperse, that's the biggest challenge right now.
I remember when my first year of SE training all those years ago, I remember thinking, oh, they're untraining me at all of my therapist skills. Yeah. I have to forget everything I've been taught in order to learn how to do this and then incorporate it back into the way I practice. a lot of the conversations that I've been having recently on the Groundless Ground have been coalescing around thoughts are not all they're cracked up to be. And to hang your healing hat on a bunch of thoughts doesn't really amount to much in the end.
Unless that can trickle down into the body and create a different somatic experience, I do not believe that there's much to be gained by just working at the level of the cognitive.
We've had enough years of that to know that neurobiologically, conceptual mind and conceptual thinking has very little to do with direct experience through the five senses. These are two completely different neurobiological networks. Experiential focus has very little to do with narrative, and most of the thoughts that someone with an eating disorder would be having would be internally generated narrative thoughts that are distorted at the very beginning of the thought by some of the frames that they've been exposed to that you've so eloquently described. Also, there's a lack of identification with who they actually are as a human being, because an eating disorder is a refusal to just be a being. It's an insistence that something has to be some way that is dictated by a concept.
Yes. When that subjective experience of the self, of being, is not there,
yes,
one needs to go outside of oneself to create a reality. That drives the body distortion and the rules. So the answer to eating disorders is embodiment. There's no other answer.
True. Have you found that what I consider the stickiest part of eating disorders, even when someone is no longer, quote unquote, in their eating disorder, the way they perceive their body often doesn't change? When you're working with patients, whether you're finding that there's actually a loosening and maybe a letting go of the dysmorphic view.
Yes. What we're doing is enhancing the insula. So Walter Kay has studied anorexia and shows us that the insula is actually not working optimally in clients with anorexia. It's a slow processing, even after weight restoration. And so the insula is what tells us about our interceptive experience. When we have a strong interceptive experience, we have a clear perception of ourselves, and it would not be distorted then if we were looking out from that lens, right? It would be more congruent. I think any tool that we can offer that strengthens the insula, the ability to intercept accurately, will enhance a client's ability to have a more accurate perception of themselves.
Has this research talked at all about the relationship of the insula as the pain processing center and how that would relate to strengthening the capacity for interoceptive experience from the perspective of being able to more directly perceive, rest in, and actually allow pain to be there, but then also unwind?
I don't think so. At this point, I refer clients and providers to the book Decoding Anorexia. Carrie Arnold speaks a lot about Walter Kay's research.
Well, I'm very interested in what you're saying. Everything that you've said so far about the etiology of an eating disorder would lead us to consider that there might be an intentional shutting down of the ability to be present with, to perceive directly social and emotional pain if the attachment container has been lacking.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think I've just learned something from you.
You're an expert in a field that I'm not an expert in. And so when people bring their expertise, it makes my mind go, I wonder about that.
Great.
This would also bolster the argument for somatic practices because of the interoceptive ability to directly perceive body sensation directly from the inside, but also strengthening capacity to perceive external sensations as well. I love that you're doing the sensory processing work with your patients as a way to allow them to heal.
Yes. I've been utilizing and spending time with occupational therapists lately, and they've been coming to our trainings too, which is interesting. we have this whole new field of people that we have not utilized who are very important. And then I'm in Steve Terrell's training in developmental trauma, and I'm getting trained in studying the reflexes and how do you test when they're offline and how do you integrate? And I'm testing my clients and they're all unintegrated. And so it's very exciting to see, you know, the options with the sensory motor processing that are available for intervention.
When you work with your patients, if you're finding through the somatic work that there is a greater capacity for, well, it's colloquially called self-compassion in the field, although I frankly don't really like the term, but I'm using it because maybe you have a sense of what I mean.
Yes, my clients don't like that term. It's interesting. One of my favorite phrases by Raja Selvam, who was my SE third year.
Lucky for you.
I know. He would say, have your client put their hand on the area that's constricted and then have them ask, does this feel familiar? And if it feels familiar, how old does that feel? And so going back to what age is, am I experiencing? Am I having a somatic memory?
Mm-hmm.
And beginning to relate to themselves through this lens. Oh, it's a memory. Okay, I can relate to a memory. Oh, it's a younger part of me. And so what happens when Paula and I show up for that part together? I usually model the compassion because the client does not know how to do that. I will say, I'm so sorry. I wish I was there. That must have been scary. Twice this week, my clients have said, I don't like that word, self-compassion.
Well, how do you feel about it?
It's become a buzzword now. And so they get turned off by it. Or it probably bumps up against the self-rejecting parts. And the self-rejecting parts, you know, don't want to let it in. It has to come in through the back door. They're not apt to take it in directly. You have to invite them into an experience of self-compassion without them knowing that that's what you're doing.
We're saying bottom up, not top down. The conceptual framework that you don't love yourself is something they already know viscerally because they've basically been starving themselves or hurting their internal organs by throwing up. They know this and the shame around that.
Yes.
Too difficult to go near. So if you bring another top-down structure, which tells you you're something, therefore you're not something else, rather than just building the bridge back to the innate relationship with this beautiful thing we call a body and how beautiful that natural relationship can be, that is innate compassion without a self.
Well said. And that goes back to the first thing I was talking about with the field is trying to shift clients to have a different body image by talking about the body. You cannot shift body image by talking about it. You need a new experience in it.
So you can shift concept about the body. What you cannot shift is experiential focus and interoceptive relationship with the body. That kind of body imaging will only further strengthen any kind of attachment rupture or attachment defense structure the person's already working on board with, right? Because it's so dissociating anyway.
And feed the shame, which you've mentioned.
Yes.
Asking a client what they've eaten and how much they've eaten and how much they've engaged in their disorder feeds the shame.
So people have a greater understanding from someone who clearly does this work so beautifully. You rightly mentioned very early on, the whole idea of mindfully dropping into the body can be the very last thing someone with an eating disorder wants to do, even thinks they could do, for all kinds of reasons. So I'd like you to talk about this from the lens of shame, having these beautiful techniques to invite your patients to have direct experience with the body. And yet I imagine when they have direct experience of the actual condition of their body, especially if they've been in an eating disorder for a very long time, they must come up against natural arising of shame and embarrassment, even disgust, our most strong emotion.
I work on the periphery with the safest parts of the body. It's so titrated. Holding a warm cup in your hand and feeling the warmth of the cup. People with eating disorders usually don't have issues with their fingers or their hands, right? Never go for the stomach, the hip, anything that would be loaded. And we might start with pleasant sensation in the hands and warmth, then work with scent and using aromatherapy, noticing what that does so they can be with that. We may work with swaddling or weighted blankets to enhance the connection to the skin, to increase regulation and settle the nervous system. So I'm going to direct their attention to safer places.
Something neutral.
Yes. I would maybe work with the kidney, and they don't have a lot of thoughts about their kidney. You know, it's just less loaded and has less of a narrative attached to it.
We're talking about you doing some touch therapy work in the way that Kathy Kane teaches.
Exactly. A hot water bottle in the kidney. I use a sensory pad for the feet.
Mm-hmm.
So for someone with a lot of body shame, it's very titrated, small moments of connection with safer part of the body, invoke or invite pleasure or comfort or less distress.
Do you find they're resistant to the experience of pleasure at first?
Their expectation would be that that doesn't exist. It would be a surprise when they identify something that could be pleasant. So it needs to be very slow and titrated and given to them in small doses. And then the next session, I might give a little more and a little more.
Titration is very important.
Very important.
Can you say a little more about, in the context of eating disorders, why titration is so important for these individuals?
Let me put it this way. People who develop eating disorders tend to have a sensitive disposition. I believe that that's reflective of early experiences that then leave them to be fairly intuitive, very open to stimulation and the environment. This is the paradox. People with eating disorders are dissociated from their bodies. People with eating disorders feel everything at the same time. They're dissociated from their bodies because they feel everything.
Mm-hmm.
How do we bring them into contact with their own body? But how do we also help them titrate their experience with the world? Sometimes the eating disorder is happening because they need a boundary because they experience everything. So the titration is about the relationship with themselves and bringing themselves into contact with their body, but also teaching them how to titrate the world that they're interacting with.
Well, this is interesting. You just named all the models in DBT. DBT would say that these are the very things that have to be on board for emotion regulation.
Yes.
You've just come at it from a completely bottom-up somatic-based frame.
Thank you for saying that.
I can see all of your amazing early training in many of these modalities. Your methodology is a beautiful integration of many truths about eating disorders. And yet it's almost as though you're on a very different train track. Mm-hmm. The stops are the same, mm-hmm. but your train track is different. It's remarkable. When I hear you, I say to myself, this should be what every treatment center is doing. If they're doing anything other than this, they're wasting people's money. And yet it's so difficult to train people in how to do this.
I agree. One of the things that sensory motor offers that I didn't get as much from SE is the way attachment supports regulation.
Of course.
So that, I think, is a piece that is way overlooked in eating disorder treatment centers. There are groups that say eating disorders are a brain disorder and has nothing to do with the attachment experience.
Well, they do say that about depression. They say that about anxiety.
Yeah.
They say that about pretty much any mental health-related disorder. We can't fault the eating disorders community for that.
The piece about our training, I haven't talked a lot about body-mind centering, body-brain bridges work. There's movement patterns that support healthy attachment. The relational cycle that all infants go through is yield, push, reach, grasp, pull, back to yield. And so when those are truncated in the attachment system, that is when we start to see strategies develop in order to maintain the attachment. That's a beautiful, I think, contribution to our model that also has not been looked at. How do we assess if a client has truncated push or truncated reach? How does that show up in the eating disorder? And then how do we intervene at the sensory motor level?
Did you learn this particular framework when you were doing the movement?
That is actually Rachel's contribution to our training.
Wonderful.
She studied body-mind centering. When she was in sensory motor, she saw the layering of Bonnie Bainbridge's work with the attachment. And then she was working in the same eating disorder facility as a trauma therapist. It didn't have a background in eating disorders, but she's a body worker. And now I'm moving more towards the body work. So we're sort of now, we're going to end up in the middle together. But I do want to respect her contribution and the sensory motor contribution to our model. So there's whole treatment centers that are DBT focused for eating disorder. That's their focus. What happens is the therapists stand over the client when they're in hyperarousal or hypoarousal and say, which DBT scale do you need to use right now? Which of course they can't access because their prefrontal cortex is shut down. So then the client is frustrated. The therapist is frustrated. I think there's space for the DBT skills, but they need to understand about hyper and hypoarousal in the window of tolerance because your clients can't actually use these skills if they're in the window.
Problem here is that in order to include that, DBT would have to admit that a behavioral framework doesn't work. We're not Pavlov's dog. Yeah. We're much more sophisticated and we will come up with really great sophisticated methods to keep the prefrontal cortex offline because that's what we need in that moment, even if we're not aware of it. My experience with new patients who've been through DBT programs for any number of things, because they're very popular and they are helpful. And I'll ask them, well, what was your favorite DBT skill? What'd you like most about it? And mostly what I hear is, I don't know, I don't really remember much. How dissociated were they during much of that?
I have a similar story. They like the distraction skill.
Yeah, of course. Well, isn't that useful? Keeps you out of the body. It's fantastic.
Yes.
Yeah, I can see the sheet in my mind.
In our training, we invite therapists, though, that have other modalities to attend in the hopes of enhancing what they already are utilizing and providing some ideas to support their clients so they can then apply the DBT or the CBT. We want to make space for everyone. We also, you had mentioned, some of your listeners are yoga instructors. We also are starting to train treatment center staff. We've already trained one facility, and in 2018, we'll go to two others. At the training, we will start talking about the inclusion of Qigong, the inclusion of Tai Chi, the inclusion of acupuncture, the inclusion of other types of practitioners who are oriented to the body, who can resource the body.
Yeah, I find often yoga can be problematic for the very reasons that you said. But Qigong is rarely problematic for these people.
Because they are energetically so sensitive, I wonder about that it brings them into safer contact with that subtle energy.
It's entirely possible that that's true. I also think that with yoga comes a lot of concepts now. People with eating disorders, often they have images of ideals that they're supposed to be meeting. People don't really have that for Qigong. There's no beautiful Qigong body. So it's like a big mystery, the natural way in which Qigong engages the interoceptive capacity without even inviting them into it. They're just feeling things anyway that they've never felt before. It just doesn't activate them as much as yoga might.
Yes, I agree. The movement class that I taught at the facility years ago, I would do it in a circle, no mirrors. They'd do it barefoot. And it was a mixture of Qigong and some creative movement and African dance. But a lot of it was about following impulse.
Yes.
The clients would say, oh, this is the first time I've had an hour without my eating disorder thoughts. Or I've been in my body and I wasn't thinking about what I look like. My social engagement system came on. It was amazing to watch in just 1 hour what would happen.
That's experiential focus as opposed to narrative focus.
So the field has a way to go. I do believe we're at the beginning, though, of this shift. Stephen Porges was the keynote speaker a few years back. And there's a book coming out called Trauma-Informed Approaches for Eating Disorders.
Okay.
I've written a chapter in there. Rachel's written a chapter. we're at the beginning of new frontiers with eating disorder treatment.
As I said, this is the head of a wave that seems to be impacting many different things. Do you ever wonder what your treatment would have been like if you had this?
Certainly. I think my journey has not ended because symptom reduction is not recovery. And I was symptom free for 30 years, but I still had an underlying anxiety that had been there before the eating disorder. And then I still had the relational piece. So it wasn't until I entered SE and then started the touch work that I began to work with those really early pieces that were the precursors. We need to redefine recovery to not simply be symptom reduction, to, you know, see these other threads that define recovery. And recovery is about embodiment, embodiment of attachment and embodiment in general.
That would be a redefining of mental health. It's not just symptom reduction, but as innate well-being that is part of the natural experience from which they can meet any challenge. The other buzzword, resilience, a deep trust in the joy of embodiment, including when embodiment doesn't feel so good, when there's a lot of times when it doesn't feel so good. And that doesn't mean that it isn't still a joy to experience. It's never really like our mind is telling us it's going to be. It's always so much better than the story we have.
I agree.
Is there anything else you would like the listeners to either know about you or about the work you're doing? If you would like to just talk about whether or not your training is really only for people who work with eating disorders.
What I've heard from participants is the same observation you came up with, which was, oh, this is applicable to anyone. We tend to have professionals come who have any exposure to eating disorders, or maybe they're thinking about working with eating disorders. They don't need to have already been a seasoned therapist. It could be a dietitian, could be a medical provider. It could be a treatment center staff. It could be a yoga instructor, a family therapist. It's fairly broad because they are experiential. We don't go over 20, and we provide a very safe container. To learn this work, you actually have to embody it yourself. So that's unusual for a training, especially an eating disorder training. People are used to coming and sitting and getting information. We sit in a circle. We have an altar in the middle. People get to know each other quite well. They're taught in 3-day increments. You have a choice to come back for a second level of training. So the first module is 3 days. And if you feel called to this model, then you return for sequential 3-day modules. Well, one of the projects that has not come to fruition that I've worked on for 5 years, I have contacts and friends at Duke University.
Yes.
And trying to Nancy Zucker, who studies interoception, has agreed to be the PI, but we need funding and a PhD student. I'm putting that out to the universe.
Well, this is a good place to put it out to the universe. So if people want to find you, how do they do that? Where do they go?
We have a website, embodiedrecovery.org. I also will be presenting a webinar on SETI in November.
SETI is the organization that delivers the SE trainings. And when you are a member, you get these wonderful webinars. And you're going to be doing one of those in November. Well, I hope all the SE professionals will be signing up. Well, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate you taking the time to share what you and Rachel are doing.
Thank you. We are very excited, and I appreciate your support and interest in this population.
Thanks for listening to today's show. To get in touch, please visit groundlessground.com. Let's dedicate our efforts to the healing of our planet and all its inhabitants. See you next time on the Groundless Ground.